This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. There are lots of good things about being a Virginian, but by November, if you haven't already thrown away your television set, you may be longing to get away to a quiet island somewhere. We're talking, of course, about presidential election season, the fact that Virginia is now a swing state, and both sides seem determined to pour millions into TV attack ads reverberating with ever-increasing frequency in the months ahead. Enough to turn you off to politics altogether. But don't despair. There's other intriguing political news in the Old Dominion, and our crack analysis team of Kumar, Roberts, and Gibson are here to fill us in. From a surprise veto on kinship care to a surprise plan to increase gas taxes, there's a lot going on besides the presidential race that could affect you. We'll do our best to fill you in and solicit your views right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Virginia's no-new-taxes governor is proposing a series of tax reforms, some of which are not sitting well with conservative colleagues who say they amount to tax increases. Virginia's new voter ID law looks like it will go into effect before the next election, if the U.S. Justice Department approves, but it could cost much more than anyone was expecting. And speaking of cost, a bipartisan group of lawmakers thought they had an easy way to save some money on foster care and help families at the same time. But their legislation that had passed with overwhelming support has now been struck down by the governor's veto pen. So we'll be looking for further detail on each of these stories and much more this hour from our analysis team. But if there's anything going on in the world of government or politics that concerns you, please do make note of our number, 888-WMRA-TALK, whether it involves the White House, the State House, or your own backyard. If you've got news to share or questions to ask, 888-967-2825 by phone. Online, you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as Virginia Insight. Already on the phone line with us is Washington Post political reporter Anita Kumar, joining in from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the Sorensen Institute's Bob Gibson, and back here in the Insight Studios, James Madison University Professor of Politics and Public Policy, Bob Roberts. Welcome all.
Glad to be here.
Hello.
So, where should we start? Red onion prison hunger strike? Gay judges? Increasing gas taxes? Anita, you know as much as anybody tracking this story about what's going on at the Red Onion Prison.
Yes.
Some people listening haven't heard about it at all. Okay. So fill us in.
So Red Onion is in Virginia, in Southwest Virginia. It's in a really remote part of the state. It's a state prison, and it's the only super maximum security prison in Virginia. So this is, you know, the most dangerous criminals, people who have misbehaved, had, you know, problems while in prison, are there. And there's been sort of a long-standing issue with some outside groups, some legislators, some nonprofits, about whether inmates there should be kept, as the state calls them, in segregation, which basically means they don't like the term, but the term others use is solitary confinement. They're alone. Most of the time, there are occasional visits, but essentially you're in a cell by yourself with limited contact. And what's happened this week, that's been going on for some time, but what's happened this week is on Tuesday morning at breakfast time, about 44 men, I think they're just men there, inmates, male inmates, went on a hunger strike. And they have about 10 demands they're looking at. And one of them, probably the most serious, is they want to stop the indefinite, policy of segregation. So they don't want it to happen forever. You know, they don't want it to go on for years and months. And some people have been in for years.
Didn't you interview somebody who'd been there for like 14 years? Is out of prison now, and he told you some horror stories about things that happened to him.
He actually was in prison for 14 years, but he was at Red Onion for 4 of his 14, and he was convicted of armed robbery. He did. He said, in addition to just the mental problems he suffered from being alone all that time in segregation, as they call it. He said there were other...
Anita, it's okay with us if you say solitary confinement.
Okay.
Because that's, in essence, 23 hours a day in a cell by yourself.
I got to tell you, they dispute that term. Right. So I'll just tell you. We call it that in the paper, right. But the state does not much like it. Right. But anyway, this inmate said he also suffered some other abuses, that the guards beat him, and that dogs that they employ, that they have, bit him. And that you're strapped to a bed for a long period of time. And so they're saying there are other issues. I mean, the demands are huge. I mean, there's a long list. One of them even includes, we should get monthly haircuts. So
it was a story that you did earlier this year about the solitary confinement that I understand state officials don't like that term.
Yes.
But the actuality of that going on, the extent of it going on at Red Onion, that first brought a major degree of attention to this prison earlier this year. And it seems to me that I heard something about, in large part as a result of your story, that there are some state legislators who want some sort of investigation.
Yes, there's three legislators went and visited the prison, all from Northern Virginia, which obviously is not their area at all, but they just got interested in this issue. They had heard from some inmates, and they went there and toured it. And they think it's sort of led by Delegate Patrick Hope. He's a Democrat from Northern Virginia. He calls solitary confinement torture, and he says that it should stop. Other states have stopped it or eased it, and he wants Virginia to follow suit.
But the feds still does it. The feds still do it.
The feds still do it.
Absolutely.
It's true.
The feds have a number of these maximum security prisons, and so it's not that unusual. The states may have stopped it, but the federal government has not.
Delegate Hope wanted a study, an outside review, and he put in a bill during the General Assembly session, but it was killed.
Any idea how the state's going to respond to this hunger strike that just started yesterday?
No, they didn't. I got a response from them. Their response is just that Red Onion's fine. It's accredited. We don't have any problems there. But they didn't address the hunger strike. They've done the hunger strike prisoners in other states and gotten some results. I think in California they did something similar.
Yeah.
So let me say to you who are listening, we're going to jump around to lots of different topics today. And if what we've just heard about the hunger strike at Red Onion Prison is something that you want to comment on or ask a question about or anything else that we mention as we go through, and you find by the time that you get to your phone that we've jumped onto another topic, we're really good at going around in circles. We'd love to go back to something that we talked about before. The phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. We've already got some comments and questions here on Facebook, but before we get to those, since we're just on prisons, let's go to judges. And I need to issue a sort of minor warning to any parents listening. If there are young children, the next few minutes, we're going to touch on some things that relate to sex, because believe it or not, it came up in this issue of judges in the state legislature recently. So if you've got tender ears nearby, give us 5 minutes and then come back. What's the problem with being gay and trying to be a judge in Virginia, Bob Roberts?
Apparently, to conservatives in the House of Delegates, it's a big problem that they blocked a judge who had approval of the committees in the Senate and the House, Mr. Begland, I believe his name is.
Thorne Begland, isn't it? Thorne
Begland. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Thorne Begland. And then then Delegate Marshall, who's running for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate.
Longtime Republican member of the House of Delegates from Northern Virginia.
Who coordinated this somewhat strange filibuster-type action in the House of Delegates, where a lot of delegates didn't vote, and therefore they didn't get enough votes to have a vote or whatever. And he made a rather controversial statement that may got across the national media, which probably the governor did not appreciate, that sodomy was not a civil right. Marshall was immediately taken to task on that statement, because within one's own home, as long as you're adult and as long as it's consensual, it is a civil right. Recognized by the Supreme Court in 2003. So that has not helped Virginia at all. There is some move.
But by the time he made that comment, right. Delegate Marshall on national TV, his campaign to keep this gay prosecutor in Richmond from becoming a general district court judge, Prosecutor Tracy Thorne Begland, that was already successful.
Already.
Bob Gibson is somebody who covered state lawmaking for many, many years before you moved over to the Sorensen Institute. Did this situation surprise you at all?
No, and it wasn't directly dealt with in the legislature as a question of gay rights. That was not cited by those who didn't vote or those who voted against the judicial nominee as the reason they were voting against him. They had other reasons, such as the fact that he had been a member of the military and had spoken out, I believe, on Nightline back in the mid-'80s.
Correct, 90s.
Before Don't Ask, Don't Tell went into effect, and had talked about having been gay before it was popular or before there was any ability in the military to talk about that.
Well, Anita Kumar, you were there in the General Assembly into the wee hours of the morning when they were voting on judges. And it seems to me that one of the things that Delegate Marshall, who really led, it's fair to say he led the campaign that kept this prosecutor from becoming a judge. Is that correct?
I would say so. There was also a conservative group that's very influential here in Richmond, the Family Foundation,
which has
come out first.
And one of the things, if I'm remembering correctly, that I read about in your articles, that Delegate Marshall said is this man is not fit to be a judge because he had to have lied when he joined the military and at that time had to say that he was not gay, and he knew that was not true.
That's correct. There was a second issue, though, also that Delegate Marshall brought up, whether, about his, marriage. I mean, he has a partner, they have children, and he also had some issues with, in Virginia, marriage is between a man and a woman, and so he also had issues with that.
And so Mr. Thornbeglin is acting as if he is married with his partner and their children, and Mr. Marshall found that offensive.
He did.
Well, okay, now we can warn those people who turned down the radio that we're done with sex and sodomy for now, unless somebody has a question about it. In which case, let me remind you, the phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. Our analysis panel today on Virginia Insight, including Richmond-based political reporter Anita Kumar of The Washington Post, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Political Science and Public Administration Departments, Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. And for you who are listening, unless you've gotten rid of your television set completely, chances are good that you've seen a lot of ads lately for and against President Obama, as well as for and against Mitt Romney. So, simple question, what's your reaction been to those commercials? Have they made you any more likely to support one candidate over another? Again, 888-WMRA-TALK by phone, or post to us if you'd prefer to type instead of talk on Facebook. We are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. As our senior journalistic experience person, Bob Gibson, what's your impression been of what you've seen in the presidential race already in Virginia here?
Well, I think we have two kinds of ads that are coming out. We have the ads that the campaigns themselves are putting on, and those tend to be relatively mild, partially positive. And then we have the ads that are put out by the super PACs, the advocates for one side or against another side that aren't directly tied to a campaign, supposedly. And those have been harshly negative and sometimes have twisted the facts beyond recognition, according to the newspapers that done fact checks on them. So the first two Romney ads, 30-second ads, are out, and one talks about how he would, on the first day of office, he would sign legislation or sign an administrative order to get the pipeline built in the Midwest and eliminate some vague number of millions or billions of dollars of waste. And Obama's personal campaign ads are rather positive, basically saying he inherited an economic mess and the economic mess has gotten a little better since he's been in office and he doesn't forget who people are. But the real nasty stuff is the stuff that the super PACs and the outside groups are putting on. And Virginians who own television sets are going to get awfully sick and tired of these ads, I'm sure, by the time. I mean, this is May, and the election is in November, right. And they've just started. So it's really going to get bad out there.
Okay. No calls coming in yet about presidential politics. I'm just amazed. However, we do have several comments about a different variety of issues on Facebook. I'll give you this question. We'll get the answer when we get back. Don on Facebook says, have you heard of the group No Labels? If so, what do you think of them? Will any of the politicians even pay much attention to groups like this? We'll get our panel's answer when we return in just about 1 minute. We have three politics watchers with us today on Virginia Insight. Speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities over there in Charlottesville, sitting all by himself, at least for the moment, the man who heads up the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, speaking to us by phone from the offices of the Washington Post's Richmond Bureau. We have political reporter Anita Kumar. And here with me in our Insight studios in Harrisonburg, James Madison University politics professor Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. Phone number 888-WMRA Talk. Question that we had going into the break from Don: who's heard of No Labels?
And I think I was going to answer that. No Labels is one of the groups that's formed recently. I think there are a number of them that basically says they don't want to have Republicans and Democrats be so far apart. So they say they're a group comprised of Republicans, Democrats, independents, and they want to fix Washington. And so it's a group that's trying to be sort of moderate in the middle. From our perspective here in Virginia, I know that they have seemed to be fond of Senator Mark Warner, who likes to call himself a radical centrist. And I think they've even done an event or two with him.
And Bob Gibson, I know that you've heard a little bit about this group, and it reminds me, in at least reading some of their online posts, and they have a Facebook page that anybody can look at, that what they're talking about in getting both sides working together instead of just being in constant attack mode against each other is a lot of what the Sorensen Institute tries to accomplish, isn't it?
Well, it is. There are a lot of incentives in our current political morass working against that, but there are plenty of people in our political system who would like to see the two sides sit down and govern by talking to each other and actually crafting bipartisan pieces of legislation. That doesn't tend to happen in Washington these days. It does happen more often in Richmond, but there are plenty of factors working against it, including the way legislative lines are drawn so that people have to face challenges for their own party's nomination more often than they would perhaps face a competitive race in November.
Well, Don, thank you for the question, and you provide us with a perfect opportunity for a segue, speaking about the desire for bipartisanship, because Voices for Virginia's Children is a nonprofit advocacy group based in Richmond that has frequently won praise from all sides of the political spectrum for its efforts to improve the lives of Virginia kids, especially kids with health challenges, economic challenges, or with other problems in their family life. And it was in this last area, family life, that Voices and its partner organizations thought that they had won a significant victory in the recent General Assembly session with a new law that was designed to make it easier for kids to stay out of foster care and going to live with relatives when there were problems at home. But Governor McDonnell appears to have surprised the bipartisan coalition of legislators who supported this new measure when he vetoed it. So with us by phone, the senior policy attorney for Voices for Virginia's Children, Amy Woolard. Welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So in simplest terms, Amy, what would this new piece of legislation have done if it had not been vetoed?
Well, this was a surprisingly controversial bill in the end, I suppose, sponsored by Senator Barker from Fairfax, that would have provided for the school enrollment of children living in what's called informal kinship care. So these are situations where kids whose families might be in some sort of crisis, like unemployment or foreclosure or something of that nature, it's in their best interest to go and stay with a relative for a period of time until they can return home. And that would be without state intervention, without the kids coming into foster care. And SB 217 would have just allowed that grandparent or that aunt and uncle caring for the child to enroll the child in school where they live without requiring a change in formal custody.
So if I'm a grandparent and I live in Harrisonburg and my son and his wife are having problems, and there's a chance that the problems will become so great that my granddaughter would have to end up going to foster care, what many families would do in this situation, and I understand that you have statistics that say that this actually happens for thousands of families in Virginia every year, absolutely. Is that I would bring my granddaughter into my home and away from her home temporarily in Charlottesville.
Correct.
In this imaginary story. But right now, if I bring her into my home, and let's say she's 8 years old, in order to enroll her in the Harrisonburg School District, under current law, I have to go to court?
Yes, you and your son and his family would need to go into JNDR court and petition. You would need to petition for custody of your grandchild. And part
so this
of the
is
problem,
a much more arduous and in some ways expensive process than exists in many other states. And what the bill that passed with bipartisan support would have done would have made it much easier for me to enroll my grandchild in this temporary school district.
Correct.
In my school district as opposed to the one that she was in.
Exactly.
The
exactly.
governor vetoed that. Why?
The governor seems to think that in order for schools to be assured of, a grandparent or a relative as an educational decision maker, that schools need to require a court order to be assured of that. And we disagreed with the governor. I think, a lot of family attorneys that we spoke to across the Commonwealth also disagreed, and certainly our legislative and advocacy coalition that we built around the bill disagreed.
Yeah, this passed by overwhelming margins. I mean, it was something like 76
yes.
votes out of 100 in the House, and I don't know, but a huge margin in the Senate as well.
I think we had one vote against it in the Senate in the end.
So we have Bob Roberts here, who is both a lawyer and a professor, as well as a public policy wonk. You should see the look on his face as as he's shaking his head about what the governor did. You want to share?
No, the only explanation that I thought he might have used, some school districts might have complained that some parents might use this as a way to get around school attendance boundaries. In other words, they would want their kid to go to a better school, so they send them to the grandparents in a better school district. But
right.
that
and
didn't come up, did it?
It came up during the legislative session from a few school divisions. But what I want to emphasize is that we did work with those school divisions. We recognized that that was a concern. And so built into this
okay.
bill was a measure that would have allowed schools to require a kind of verification of the relationship from the local Department of Social Services. So there was a kind of safeguard built in to address that would have given indication that the kinship arrangement was, legitimate, was not purely for sort of what is often called school shopping purposes,
yeah.
I suppose.
So, Amy, let me just double check here because we've only got you on the phone for another couple of moments.
Okay.
But one of your concerns is that unless the situation changes, unless you get the kind of legislation into law that you had hoped to this year, what you're afraid of is that kinship arrangements will be more difficult to make. Grandparents and aunts and uncles will be far less likely to be able to take a child temporarily into their home because they can't get them into their local school district. And so this is more likely to push more kids into foster care?
Correct. And that's really what we've seen happen anecdotally as well. Before I was with Voices, I was a practicing education attorney, and I was representing kids in foster care. And I would get calls from social workers all over the state who were trying to make these kinds of kinship placements, as the local social services often do, in order to prevent kids from coming into their custody. And these relationships were falling through strictly because of the school piece, not being able to be in place.
What happens now that the governor has vetoed it, vetoed legislation that originally passed with veto-proof numbers of votes? What's the next step?
Unfortunately, we're done for this year's session. So there's already been an adjournment, but we're not done with the issue. I think that, we successfully built a strong bipartisan coalition, a wide array of organizations around this issue, and we're going to continue to work on it. So the State Executive Council is tasked with studying the issue. I think the Commission on Youth is going to look at a small portion of it again. And if need be, we may be back in the legislature again next year with this piece.
Amy Woolard from Voices for Virginia's Children. Amy, thanks so much for making time for us. And if somebody wants to know more about your organization, this or any of the other causes that you're involved in, your website is vakids.org. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
How about if you repeat it for us just so people believe it for sure?
It is www.vakids.org.
Amy, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
If you have a concern or interest about anything going on that touches upon Virginia government or politics, we'd love to hear from you here on Virginia Insight at 888-WMRA-TALK. Our official analysis panel is with us, made up of Richmond-based political reporter Anita Kumar of The Washington Post, former newspaper reporter and now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Political Science and Public Administration Departments, Bob Roberts. Next, we've got somebody on Interstate 81 who hopefully has safely pulled off. Keith, in the midst of his travels, is called us. Keith, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. Just a quick comment about you were talking about the political ads.
Yeah.
Regardless of side, Republican, Democrat, Obama, or Romney, I don't believe anything that any ad says. I'll listen to, I like being informed, but ads don't inform. They're terrible. I turn them off as soon as I can.
Now, that's an interesting issue because the campaigns sincerely believe the negative campaign ads work, or they wouldn't be running them. And therefore, it's interesting that that whether these ads will really shift any voters or not. Particularly, I think the most interesting ads are the Super PAC ads, because those ads are so out of whack, in other words, blatantly false, that it's going to be fascinating what impact those Super PAC ads have, whether they actually hurt a candidate or help them, because they're supposed to be not connected at all with the candidate they're supporting. And we've seen tons of those Super PAC ads, which are the first time we've really seen that numbers in this state.
Keith, I really do empathize with your pain. The one thing that it occurs to me that maybe ought to be mentioned is it is accurate to say, Bob Gibson and Bob Roberts, that millions of dollars are going to be coming into
Absolutely.
Virginia this year with advertising from both sides. Is that, would you
many,
say?
Many millions.
Many okay. millions.
That has got to be creating or at least assuring jobs. You know, all of those television salespeople who are selling advertising are keeping their jobs. Maybe television stations are hiring more people because they got these millions of dollars going. So, Keith, maybe you could imagine it is sort of like a jackhammer outside your house or apartment where there's construction going on. And it's annoying, but at least it means that some people are getting paychecks.
Well, I guess. One thing about ads in general, one thing college taught me is how to, you know, to think things through critically. And when you do that with these ads, you realize that, you know, they fall apart. As far as creating jobs, well, I'm not necessarily worried about them. the advertisers, I mean the ad creators. If it were construction jobs, great. You know, have them construct, you know, big concrete signs. That'd be putting people to work. Maybe they could put them under some of the bridges that are falling down.
So maybe some of these millionaires who were contributing hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to these campaigns, you think maybe they could create a fund for building bridges?
Right, but they don't care about them. So.
Keith, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you for this program. Bye-bye.
Yes, Anita.
You know, you've mentioned the presidential ads, but we also have one of the probably closest, tightest, most watched Senate races.
And surprisingly, we haven't seen much
on
that race.
So far, Tim Kaine and George Allen, I don't think, have run ads themselves, but they have super PACs.
Right.
So there's been at least three groups for George Allen so far, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and then some other groups. So, I mean, we've seen some stuff, but I suppose after the primary, providing George Allen wins in June, we're really going to see a lot coming this fall.
Phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. If you have a comment or question about anything to do with politics, we also understand that there is someone coming from a distance trying to find their way to our radio station this afternoon. Let me say to that person, you can call our toll-free number, and the friendly operators will give you directions for how to find the station. 888-967-2825. Whether you want a comment or you just want some friendly help. Mike in Charlottesville, thank you for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, this goes back to your statements involving conditions at Red Onion.
Yes, sir.
I look at it, I come from a law enforcement family, military service family, and a first responder myself for over 3.5 decades of service in that area, having picked up the pieces, in some cases, literally, of the results of the criminal activities these people are convicted of. Personally, it's not about rehabilitation. It's about punishment. Want to reduce the crime rate? You make prison such a fearful place that people will want to avoid going there. You will reduce the crime rate. It's been, they did terrible things. They don't deserve to be treated nicely. They need to understand they have to pay.
Yeah.
And they have to pay in the most terrible way for it to be a deterrent.
But the problem with that approach is that the Supreme Court has established rather strict guidelines in terms of how you can treat prisoners.
This is Bob Roberts.
And in a sense, you cannot, even though they've committed terrible deeds, you cannot subject prisoners to conditions that will cause long-term psychological injury or physical injury. And so the question that these prisons are facing across the country, are they subjecting inmates to long-term psychological coercion issues that may run afoul of the U.S. Constitution? And I think that's why these prisons are being looked at much more carefully. Not that you can't lock them up. Not that you can't put them in very strict conditions. That you can't isolate them so they go literally crazy. And I think that's the issue that we face.
Mike, let me just double check. Did you say you worked in law enforcement for many years?
No, I have a family member who was in law enforcement and was an elected sheriff. And I have experience in the EMS field for many, many years, having seen firsthand the results of these crimes, both directly on victims and in some cases, for example, going and picking up attempted suicides from collateral damage with some very heinous crimes. And, you know, the thing is, these people, in many cases, you can't grow a conscience. If they're sociopathic, if they, you know, are a danger even to other prisoners, then, you know, how do you protect even the other smaller prisoners, other less serious prisoners from those true predators?
Mike, we've got some other calls to take, but I sure do appreciate you taking the time to share your perspective with us. Thank you very much. Next to Lexington, Susan is joining us on Virginia Insight. Susan, your question or comment for Anita Kumar, Bob Gibson, and or Bob Roberts, please.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the governor's veto of the bill that would have allowed children to attend schools with kinship placements.
Sure.
And would have kept more children out of foster care. I am certainly aware that in foster care in Virginia, the vast majority of children end up in residential treatment. And most of those residential treatment facilities are provided by a company called Universal Health Services here in Virginia. It's a multi-billion-dollar corporation across the country and a huge supporter of Governor McDonald. UHS, and also known as Psychiatric Solutions Incorporated, run the vast majority of residential placements here in Virginia and certainly have done everything they can, as I follow them, to support the governor in stopping any bills that would make it easier for children to stay out of foster care, because that's how they make their money.
Are you saying that large numbers of Virginia children who are in foster care are in these facilities and not in homes?
Yes, the vast majority.
The vast majority?
And if, excuse me?
The vast majority?
Yes. And if you talk to any child that's been in foster care, even if they're not in it right now, at some point they have been. And it's kind of interesting that you're talking about the other thing about people in isolation.
Susan, we're going to hit the break here. Can you hold on for us?
Sure.
We'll be back in 1 minute. Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for more than 30 years before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar got a post on our Facebook page today commenting that her picture made her look almost as young as when she was in high school.
I love that.
She responded with a request to not tell anybody just when those high school years were. So we won't, but we can tell you that those years those years were spent in Charlottesville.
That's right.
Now, all these many decades later, Anita is based in Richmond covering Virginia politics for the Washington Post. My name's Tom Graham, by the way. This is Virginia Insight. We still got Susan on the line. Bob Gibson, you had a thought about Susan's comments on foster care.
Well, I think they were fascinating. I think it's the kind of thing that newspapers and the press and the media need to look into to find out the true factors at play in politics here, because ideologically, it would seem to be something that many people in both parties would support, and yet going against this legislation, there have to be reasons, and this is one to investigate.
And I was not aware that you had that many foster care children in these facilities. I thought it was a relatively small number, and I know these facilities have been criticized, but if it was such a large number, you're talking about rather large dollars that would have to be paid to these private corporations. That's what you're saying?
They pay about $1,000 a day per child, and the majority of the children in the facilities are foster children.
So do you have an idea that the total amount that are being spent by the state for these children in these facilities?
$250,000 a year per child.
But in terms
and
of
that money comes through Medicaid, through state funding, through CSA, you're talking about the Commission on Youth. The State Executive Council oversees that funding. I've been in front of them numerous times talking about this. And it's simply painful for people to admit, to watch, to deal with the fact that we're putting children in a treatment that, one, has been proven to be dangerous and effective.
Susan, I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, but I'm sure many people listening are getting a sense that this is a very important issue to you, and in your work, this is something that you
No, we had adopted a son and who had been horrifically abused, and we've been following the issue for a number of years. I mean, I didn't know anything about it until I started finding out, and then it was like, how can we allow this to happen in Virginia? We do a treatment that we know doesn't work. I mean, there's no research. There's nothing to show that it works. The gentleman that owns UHS, Alan Miller, built the business school at William & Mary. There's a lot of contacts. There's the UHS facilities. You were talking with about the Daily Progress. They've had Whisper Ridge up in Charlottesville. They've got Liberty Point, Stanton, the Pines. They just closed another facility. It's like a shell game.
Anita Kumar, is your interest piqued there at all?
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, I mean, I feel like we've had a discussion about this, but we haven't really said what the governor said, whether you agree or disagree with him. And he did outline some issues in his veto letter. Also, he said his office said that he was, now I know it was overwhelmingly passed, but that he did have some legislators lobby him on the issue, including the Speaker of the House, who encouraged him to veto the bill. So, you know, he wasn't alone. It sounds like there were some influential folks. I'll just read you a sentence from his veto letter. It says, a court order, given the often fluid and tragic circumstances that generally generate kinship custody arrangements, a court order provides children and families with the stability, certainty, and oversight to ensure that kinship arrangements are necessary or appropriate in light of changing circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Well, Susan, you've certainly given us more to think about and to pursue, so thank you very much for your call. James in Harrisonburg, we know that you've been waiting for a while, but there is an issue that we promised earlier we would get to. So if you could keep hanging on, we'll get to you after we talk about tax reform.
The governor had a few weeks ago implied he was open to tax reform. We've heard a lot of tax reform in the national level. And his idea of tax reform that he raised or ran up the flagpole was possibly indexing the gasoline tax so it would go up as inflation would go up, because Virginia has one of the lowest gasoline taxes in the country.
Stayed the same since 1986.
And we're running out of money in our highway trust fund. He also, the more interesting proposal was to cut the sales tax and extend sales taxes to services, including the article that was read, your hospital bills, in other words, or a massage or anything, would those providers would have to collect the sales tax.
So if he cut the sales tax from 5% to 4%, in addition to paying sales tax on
food,
batteries, except for this weekend with a hurricane exception, I would also have to pay taxes when I go to my dentist.
Or your dry cleaner. or any service, and that would raise a lot of money because our economy is so service driven. The problem,
and what he's saying for that, and what he's saying for gases with gas tax with pegging it to inflation, in real terms, you're talking about most everybody paying more total in taxes every year. You're nodding your head.
It's debatable. In other words, if you cut the sales tax and broad,
you can't nod your head yes and then say it's debatable.
He didn't say that. He didn't say that. He didn't say it would result in more taxes. He thought it would be fair taxes. In other
words, he talked about it in terms of revenue neutrality, didn't
he? Yeah, absolutely. And that the sales tax would be fairer to businesses. That if I'm operating a Costco and I have to collect sales taxes, and I'm in a hospital, I don't have to collect sales taxes. That's not really fair. In other words, that everybody, anyone who's selling a service, should pay a sales tax.
But many of his conservative Republican colleagues who oppose this because they see it as a potential tax increase.
Absolutely.
Thank you. You stop nodding your head. Now, James in Harrisonburg, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Well, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Back to the discussion of incarceration again. The public debate seems to focus on two alternative goals, which are punishment or rehabilitation, and nobody seems to mention the priority one for me, and that's my protection from violent criminals.
But they see the debate over the prison we're talking about isn't letting those prisoners out of the prison. It's how they're treated within the prison. And therefore, that question of we're incarcerating record amounts of individuals in this country. We have probably the highest incarceration rate in any democracy in the world. The question is, how do you treat those individuals once you have them in prison?
I think the number of incarcerated people is a completely separate topic. The discussion that we're having has to do with violent criminals, and it's an entirely different debate as to whether or not we should be incarcerating people for petty crimes. The issue here is that nobody seems to take into consideration the best way to protect people from violent criminals.
James, we started this discussion because a hunger strike started at Virginia's maximum security prison, Red Onion, yesterday. Prisoners demanding to be treated better and to no longer spend so much time, sometimes years at a time, in solitary confinement. Do you have an opinion about whether solitary confinement for years at a time is appropriate?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing the perspective that you have. Let's get to a couple of the other Facebook questions that have come in. This is Christopher. I'm going to direct this to you, Bob Gibson, if I could. Christopher says, I understand that people being able to openly carry a gun in Virginia cuts down on crime, but recently someone came into a restaurant that I was visiting with a gun on his hip, and it made me and my friend somewhat uncomfortable. I would have felt much better knowing that this gun owner had to have gone through some training and acquired a permit in order to openly carry a gun. Why doesn't Virginia require permits for all gun owners?
Well, that's easy. The Second Amendment. Virginia has laws that allow anyone who wants to go to a court to apply for a concealed carry permit to get one regarding a minimal amount of training, but training is seen as a good thing, and people who have concealed carry permits are seen as generally safe carriers who at least are trained. But it's been everyone's right in Virginia to openly carry in many places for a long time.
So, without any kind of training
correct.
Or permit.
Without any kind of training. So it's a trade-off. If you have a concealed carry permit law, you have some training usually required. And if you have reciprocity with other states, you may have training required. But if you have open carry, it's a right under the Second Amendment the way Virginia interprets it.
I would talk to the restaurant owner and say, you know, you might want to have a sign that you can't do that. In other words, the restaurant.
Because businesses are prevented from or can prevent people from
absolutely.
Coming
business
into the
businesses can set their own rules, yes.
They can set their own rules. And therefore, if I'm upset about that, I'd go to the owner of the business and say, that made me very uncomfortable, you know, and I may not come back here. Maybe you want to not let people do that.
Anita Kumar, there is a move in the General Assembly, isn't there, to change even the concealed carry permit law so that people would no longer have to go through any training or get a permit to carry a gun concealed?
Yes. I mean, there's moves every year to to, well, there's moves in both directions, but generally there have been moves recently to try to ease gun laws, and, you know, they succeeded some this year. So, you know, I guess we'll see what happens in the future, but they are going that way.
This question on Facebook from Lauren, who says, whatever happened to transportation as an issue? Didn't the current governor run for office promising he had a plan to find more money for it? Did that ever happen? Things aren't bad here in the Charlottesville area yet, but friends in other parts of Virginia say the traffic jams are still awful and getting worse.
He did run on that. That was one of his issues. He had a lengthy plan when he was running for governor. Some of those things he's worked on, some of them not so much. Some of the things he's mentioned are he wants, you know, oil drilling off the coast, and the proceeds from that would go to transportation. As most people know, we don't have oil or gas drilling off the coast. It's not allowed by the federal government. So some things, you know, just didn't happen. He did, last session, so a year ago in 2011, he did convince the General Assembly, probably his biggest transportation issue was he convinced them to bond or, you know, borrow money for construction projects. This year he did float a bill to have some more money for maintenance, but the General Assembly did not like his proposals. Basically, he doesn't want to raise taxes. He knows that he cannot get that through the General Assembly. So they were trying to basically divert some other money that was going to other things to transportation. But the
Democrats making the argument that if you take money out of the general fund, then what you're doing is taking money away from health care and education.
Right. That's exactly right.
And the state is moving ahead with private-public partnerships, like we're seeing in the Tidewater area.
Right.
Where we're using tolls to pay for.
Although the tolling was put off for a year.
It was put off for a year. But he was very much a strong backer of those public-private partnerships,
mm-hmm.
and implicit in those agreements were the ability to collect tolls. And so he's been a strong supporter of tolling the interstates even, in other words, to get additional revenue,
mm-hmm.
but not raising taxes.
Voter ID law. Who wants to tell us what's happening with that? Okay.
What happened is that the governor did not veto the bill that came out of the legislature. He was concerned about certain provisions of it. The Justice Department still has to approve it.
In essence, the law says that you have to carry some sort of acceptable identification.
And a lot of different
things. That proves
that
you say who you are,
right.
and you live where you say you live,
right.
before you can vote, and you have
right.
to bring it with you
right.
to the polling place.
Right.
Or if you don't have it, and it's any number of pieces of
right.
identification that might be accepted, if you don't have one of those, then you've cast a provisional ballot and can bring evidence to the voter registrar within a week to show that you are indeed
right.
a registered voter.
He signed it, and when he signed it last week, he issued an executive order, and he basically said every voter in Virginia and their registered voter, there's 4.7 million, has to get a voter card, a card in the mail, so that they would understand what they needed to do.
Right.
But
and,
that card would also be acceptable ID if you bring that with you to the polling place?
I believe so. Is that correct, guys? I'm not sure.
I think so, yes.
The card would be acceptable.
Would be acceptable. And so they said that this Board of Elections said that they would they'll do that. It's at a cost of $1.4 million, but they cannot do it. There's a primary next month. They won't be able to do it in time for that, but they'll do it in time for the November election.
Right.
And I think he was just trying to – he had a lot of issues with that bill. I actually was surprised he signed it. But I think the card was his way of sort of trying
That's right.
to moderate it a little bit and say, well, we're going to make it a little bit better.
We're almost out of time. And Anita, I understand that people are going to read about this in the Washington Post tomorrow under your byline. But can you give away a little bit of what you just learned earlier this afternoon having to do with the Republican race for governor in
yes.
Virginia?
So funny we're talking about 2013 when we've got so much 2012, but so many people are. You know, it's a little bit inside baseball, but the bottom line here is there's a race already going on between the lieutenant governor, Bill Bowling, and the Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, both Republicans. Some other folks are running for some other, you know, we've got some other people on the Democratic side, but basically this is a serious race between these two guys. And they've been sort of fighting, or their supporters have been fighting, over whether they should have a primary next year or a convention. And the conventional wisdom is that a convention would be much easier for the Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, to win, and a primary may not be easier, but would be would be more helpful to the Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling. Well,
convention is where the diehard, most extreme element of a party turn out,
right.
whether it's on the right in the Republican Party or on the left in the Democratic Party. And it seems almost assured that if a convention is held instead of the primary for Republicans that had been planned, that that's really good for Ken Cuccinelli's chances to get the nomination.
And Cuccinelli has long favored conventions, and Bill Bowling has long favored primaries. So it was an issue of who's going to do better. It's also, you know, who has the sway. And so the state, the Republican Party of Virginia, the governing board that governs that party, makes that determination. Well, a long time ago, last year actually, 2011, they decided that for 2013, they would hold a primary for attorney general, lieutenant governor, and governor. Well, now there's been a series of elections in the last few weeks on who sits on that board, on that committee, the 81-member committee, and it's a lot of Cuccinelli people got on, and they want to switch it to a convention.
And so,
do they need a two-thirds vote, Anita, to switch it?
Yeah, they need to get it back on the agenda, and they just did that today. And I'm not actually sure what number they need, but I believe they need two-thirds to actually get it
So they're in the process of looking to make a change that would favor the attorney general's chances of becoming governor.
Yes. Yes.
Our guests have been speaking to us from the Charlottesville studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the director of the University of Virginia's Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson, plus professor of politics and public policy from James Madison University, Bob Roberts, and with us by phone, Washington Post political reporter, Charlottesville native, and super young, Anita Kumar.
I love that.
Thank you all for making time for
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.